Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Jeffrey Schulson, who teaches at the University of Connecticut, here to talk about his new book, Fictions of Conversion, Jews, Christians, and Cultures of Change in Early Modern England, out in 2013 from University of Pennsylvania Press. Jeffrey, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thank you, Jason. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. So let's jump right in. Set the context for us. For those of us who are not familiar with early modern England, what's going on in the 1500s in England to set up the background for the book?
Well, it's an exceptionally volatile period in English history. It's the period that sees England undergo enormous changes politically, culturally, socially, and religiously. It's the period in which England ceases to be affiliated with the Catholic Church, part of the larger Roman Catholic Church, and finds its way rather peripatetically and through fits and starts eventually into becoming the Protestant nation that it remains in many respects even to this day. As a part of this religious transformation, there are also all sorts of, and related to those religious transformations are all kinds of political changes that are happening and that culminate in really probably one of the most important periods within the history of the English monarchy, the Elizabethan period, which sees the extensive consolidation of power under the crown and a kind of centralization of power within England as well.
So there's a lot of political and religious change going on, and you start the book talking about the different monarchs and how it went from Catholic to Protestant, back to Catholic, back to Protestant.
That's right.
What's going on there?
Right. So I'll bet some of the listeners are familiar with some basic outlines of this story. Initially, England was part of the larger Catholic world, which was the main expression of Western Christianity for very nearly more than a thousand years. And around the same time, though not initially for the same reason, that Martin Luther was fomenting a certain kind of split from and ultimately a reformation within the church on the continent, England was also beginning to separate itself from the Catholic Church. And that initially took the form of a break that was in response to Henry VIII's desire to change wives. He had originally been married to Catherine of Aragon. And when, for a variety of reasons, he chose no longer to be married to her, he sought an annulment of the marriage from the Pope, who refused to give it to him for a variety of religious and political reasons. And that precipitated a break from the Catholic Church. Now, why this is important is because it was not initially a break that was the product of certain kinds of theological disputes in the way that Luther's break from the Catholic Church was. So that even within what became the Church of England, many of the religious practices, the liturgy, the ways in which religious behaviors were performed was not all that different from the Catholic Church that England had broken itself away from. But over the course of the next several decades, English divines and other readers of European texts who had come under the influence of Luther's writings and eventually also under the influence of Calvin's writings, sought to push the break from the church to be a much more extensive one, a much more thoroughgoing one that would involve all kinds of reforms to English religious practice. And that that process accelerated initially under the rule of Henry's successor, his son Edward, didn't last very long on the throne, but during his time as king, much more radical changes were put into place. Now, the problem is that after Edward died, on the question of succession, the next to take the throne was Mary. And Mary was herself the daughter of Catherine of Aragon and herself remained a loyal Catholic. And she returned England to being Catholic during her period of reign and made it illegal and difficult for anyone to continue in the more reformed approach, the more reformed direction that had been instituted by her predecessors, and that resulted in a number of the more radical Protestants leaving England, putting themselves into voluntary exile in Geneva and elsewhere. And And England remained Catholic under Mary's reign until she was displaced by Elizabeth, who took the throne in 1558. And when her returned, when she became queen, she there was some speculation about this, but she eventually made England back into the Protestant nation that it had been. So it had gone from Catholic to Protestant to Catholic to Protestant over the course of about 40 or 50 years. And during that time, all sorts of religious changes were being experimented with, tried out. Some were being implemented and then being retracted. Some were being pushed further. It became a real challenge for, as it were, the common English person to figure out exactly where and how his or her religious loyalties should be assigned.
So during this time of religious and political change, what are the fictions of conversion?
Well, in light of the sort of brief religious history that I've just described, it's not surprising that it was it became necessary for many English men and women to develop a certain kind of adaptability to religious change, to identify perhaps at one point with and attend Catholic church services, and then at another point, whether or not it was a function of their own religious change of heart, to conform to the new Protestant regime, and perhaps yet once more with Mary on the throne to go back to attending Catholic church and attending Catholic mass. It was a characteristic of English religious practice during this period that many had to be prepared to change. They had to be prepared to change their identification, to assign their allegiance to and their loyalties to one church and then to another church. And so what I've called fictions of conversion is a kind of a larger term to describe the necessary. And by fictions, I don't mean it necessarily in any kind of derogatory fashion, but in a way that suggests the kind of ongoing constructed nature and the kind of reconstructing nature of religious identity during the period. Religious instability, religious change was a kind of characteristic feature of English life during the 16th century. And I've assigned the term fictions of conversion to that sort of experience of religious change and religious instability that characterizes the period. The next step in the argument of the book is to suggest that because this instability was itself a source of considerable anxiety and it could be very unsettling, one of the ways in which English cultures sought to sort of solve this anxiety or to resolve this anxiety was to assign that instability, to project it onto a kind of religious other who could serve as the focal point of many of those anxieties and who could, as it were, siphon off some of those anxieties so that they would not necessarily be as pressing to the sense of English religious identity that was emerging. And that religious other is the figure of the Jew. This is a particularly compelling solution or attractive solution in paradoxically precisely because Jews, for the most part, simply didn't live in England during this period. They had been exiled from England back in the end of the 13th century and had not yet returned in any numbers to England during the 16th century. So they were a kind of absent presence in England and the English imagination, and as such could be kind of assigned a certain kind of identity or have an identity invented for them against which no reality could contradict it. There weren't real Jews to compare to the kind of imagined Jews that begin to populate English imagination during this period. And it's that capacity to kind of serve as this cipher for ideas about conversion and about change and about instability that makes the figure of the Jew so compelling during this period and accounts, in my view, for the sort of the appearance of Jewish figures in ways that might otherwise be unexpected throughout the period.
Interesting. So paradoxically, because there are so few actual Jews, the figure of the Jew or the imaginary Jew takes on a certain power within early modern England. Is that right?
That's exactly right. and can become anything in some ways, and most interestingly, can become in some ways opposite things, can be constructed in ways that are seemingly contradictory to one another. Figures who represent the perils of inauthentic religious transformation on the one hand, but also figures who represent the possibilities and the promise of religious salvation on the other hand. They can serve both purposes simultaneously because they are these kinds of incredibly flexible imaginary figures.
And so certain anxieties are projected onto the figure of the Jew. The figure of the Jew serves as a lightning rod for some of these cultural anxieties, ambiguities.
That's right. That's right. And accounts for why they emerge in certain kinds of texts. I mean, probably, again, many of your listeners will be familiar with someone like Shylock from The Merchant of Venice, who's a sort of an obvious example of this. But Shylock is one of several Jews who populate the English stage in one form or another, and who offer these very compelling figures who are simultaneously sources of threat, but also sources of possibility.
Wonderful. So let's take us through the chapters, because you have five chapters through which you build your argument. And in the first chapter, you look at key figures in English writings about religious conversion. So tell us more about
that. That's right. So the work of the first chapter is really to establish this nexus, this connection between English writings about religious conversion that are not especially or immediately or obviously connected to questions of Jewishness with the figure of the Jew. So I take up a number of different writings about religious change during the period that are specifically and most directly about shifts between Protestantism and Catholicism, and the pressures that impinge upon Catholics to transfer their loyalties to the Protestant Church, or efforts by Catholics to retain their identity, if not openly, then secretly within this context of this pressure. And I read a number of different writers on these questions of the shift between Catholicism and Protestantism, and locate within them a number of different kinds of depictions and a certain kind of language that's used that I then attach to or connect with much more explicit ways in which Jews are described and Jews are written about during this period, so that the same language that comes to characterize and become the means through which English writers explore and struggle with their own sense of religious instability is a language that we can see also attached to Jewish conversion, the hopes for and the fears about Jewish conversion in the early modern period. Now, this is all, of course, particularly relevant because of the kinds of Jews that most Englishmen would have, if they had any familiarity at all with Jews during this period, they would have almost exclusively been themselves Jews who had been the products of the forced conversions and ultimately the expulsions from the Iberian Peninsula that begin in the 14th and 15th century. So Jews who had been living in Spain and Portugal and who had been forced to convert and sometimes are identified as Marranos, sometimes as Conversos, sometimes as Crypto-Jews, who then for various reasons left Iberia some of them established a new community in the Netherlands. Some of them remained Christian, but others chose that opportunity to recover or reclaim their Jewish identity. And it was these Jews and conversos that Englishmen who were living in the Low Countries in the Netherlands might have had some more intimate contact with. So the very idea of conversion itself was attached to Jews specifically because of the immediate history that these Jews had themselves undergone. So that first chapter explores this kind of nexus of conversion in relation to Protestantism and Catholicism on the one hand and Jews on the other. The second chapter then looks specifically at biblical precedents for English writings about conversion. And in particular, I'm interested there in four biblical figures from the Hebrew Bible, or as the Christian reader would refer to it, the Old Testament, who were taken as prototypes for conversion. Two men and two women. The men are the figure of Jethro, who is Moses' father-in-law, figure of Naaman, who is a general in the Assyrian army, who appears in the Book of Kings, in 2 Kings. And then the two women are the figure of Rahab, the woman who helps the spies that Joshua sends to conquer the city of Jericho during in the Book of Judges, and the figure of Ruth, probably the most famous biblical convert, as it were. And I'm interested there in reading in seeing how English writers from the 16th and 17th century read these different biblical figures as precedents for expressions of the experience of or the dynamics of conversion. And some of the kinds of particular interest I explore there are the distinctions that seem to emerge between male biblical converts and female biblical converts, and sort of abstractions that attach to male biblical converts and the concerns about the body that seem to arise when writing about female biblical converts. It's not at all irrelevant to this story that both the character of Ruth and the character of Rahab figure interestingly in the genealogy that the Book of Matthew gives to the figure of Jesus. So there's a lot at stake in establishing the bona fides of these converts if they serve as essential steps in what ultimately comes to produce the Christian Messiah. So that's what my second chapter explores. So, and if you take those first two chapters together, they are really about developing a kind of vocabulary for and a sensitivity to some of the primary concerns attached to religious conversion in the period. The next three chapters take those ideas and use them to read other, what I call technologies of transformation or technologies of conversion, other modes of change that are not especially or explicitly about religious transformation, but that, as I go on to argue, draw upon the same kinds of vocabulary, the same kind, and explore some of the same concerns, and most remarkably, and in unexpected ways, have a sort of an interest in and a relation to questions of Jews and Jewishness in early modern England.
So let's talk about chapter four, because I think that's probably a very interesting one for our listeners. So that chapter is about alchemy.
Yes. So what interested me and the way I got interested in this this chapter in the first place was I came to see that there was this very interesting revival of an interest in alchemy in the late 16th and early 17th century in England, really at the very beginnings of what ultimately becomes the scientific revolution, which we now think of as being in some ways diametrically opposed to something like alchemy, which has all sorts of mystical and esoteric associations with it. But in fact, if we look back at the history of science, many of the earliest practitioners of alchemy, of the new science, were themselves interested also in what we now think of as alchemy, that there's a kind of interesting connection between them. And as I began to read a little bit more about alchemy in this period and some of the texts on alchemy in this period, I was really surprised to discover how frequently alchemy was attached to Jewishness. It was described by many as a Jewish science, as something that ultimately had its origins in Jewish mystical and esoteric writings. And so I wanted to explore what the connection between Jews and alchemy was all about. Alchemy, of course, is about transformation. It's about most obviously changing base metals to gold. But more generally, it's about refining the material world into its quintessence, into its most pure expression. And so it becomes this wonderful figure for religious conversion as well. And often we find in writings about religious conversion is language that is associated with alchemy as well. So that chapter looks at this kind of interesting and for me, what was a surprising connection between Jews and Jewishness on the one hand and alchemy on the other hand. And it then becomes for me a way of reading some very interesting literary texts from the period that draw upon these alchemical images. I read Merchant of Venice, Ben Jonson's play The Alchemist in tandem with one another, using this idea of alchemy and transformation as a way of thinking a little bit about the processes of transformation in those plays. And then I read in the slightly later period, the poetry of Henry Vaughan in the middle of the 17th century, another important poet who draws extensively on alchemical figures and images in his poetry, but is also extensively interested in the possibilities of Jewish conversion as a kind of emblem of his own religious expectations.
And then in the final chapter, you look at the well-known writer Milton, who you know maybe people wouldn't think would appear in a book of Jewish studies, but what's the connection there?
So that connection, I mean, that actually it goes back in some ways to my earlier work. My first book was on Milton and rabbinic writing, Milton and Midrash. So I've had this ongoing interest in possible connections between Milton's writings and earlier Jewish writings. But in that chapter, rather than look at Paradise Lost, which is what my focus on my last book was primarily on, I look at one of his last poems, Paradise Regained, a shorter epic poem that is basically about the identity of the Christian Messiah. And it takes up the brief story that's told in some of the Gospels of the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness by the devil, and uses that as a way of thinking about and imagining this figure of Jesus coming to understand his particular role as the Messiah. And I'm not the first to observe the coincidence, but I try to explore more deeply than others have the fact that Paradise Regained was published almost at exactly the same moment as the Sabbatean phenomenon was sweeping through Europe. And for those readers who are, or listeners who may not be as familiar, this is the movement that was prompted by the figure of Sabbatai Tzvi, the false Jewish Messiah, who managed to convince extraordinary numbers of Jews throughout Europe that he was the Jewish Messiah, and who had enormous followings before ultimately he was forced to convert to Islam by the Sultan, and left many of his followers quite disappointed. But the point here is that he was this figure who stood for not just for Jews, but ultimately also for Christians who became very interested in this phenomenon. He stood for this figure of the false Messiah, of someone who inspired all kinds of enthusiasm about the possibility of salvation, and who then ultimately disappointed those followers. And around the same time, there were a number of Christian imposters, messianic imposters as well. So the whole question of being able to verify and authenticate a claim for messianic status is very much in the atmosphere, in the ether during this period, within Jewish discourse and within Christian discourse. And so for Milton to take up this question of the authentic identity of Jesus and what that stands for at this time seems to me to be much more than simply a coincidence, but drawing upon those same questions of authenticity.
Fascinating. Thank you, Jeffrey. It's time now for the lightning round, as I'm calling it. What do you hope the impact of the book is?
Well, I see this as part of my larger efforts to try to bring to bear some of the insights of contemporary Jewish studies, which I think has a lot of exciting things going on. Bring it to bear on the study of English literary history, English literary and cultural history. There have been some recent developments in that area, not just by me, but by some of my contemporary scholars, and I think that that's a very exciting and important approach that deserves further. Further investigation. So I'm hoping to be able to kind of sensitize those readers of English literary and cultural history to these questions and to have them become much more central to their investigations rather than simply to be kind of a window dressing or a secondary or tangential set of questions. But at the same time, I think it's important for practitioners of Jewish studies to recognize the importance of seeing the ways in which these religious movements and these religious questions are part of larger cultural and literary phenomena. So I guess it works in both ways.
Great. So both sets of scholars are in different fields can learn things from each other.
Yeah, I hope I have readers in both worlds.
How has researching and writing the book changed the way you see the world?
Well, I suppose I'm certainly much more attuned to, especially as I read materials from this period, attuned to references to and statements about religious identity and religious practice that are that from what I can tell, or that I'm more sensitive to, a certain kind of anxiety that they express. The what we often read are these polemics amongst various religious groups across between Protestants and Catholics, or across Protestant denominations, or between Jews and Christians. The polemics are interesting for a variety of reasons, but one of the things I think I'm much more sensitive to now is how those polemics express certain kinds of internal anxieties that I'm interested in discovering.
So, Jeffrey, I'm at a cocktail party. What tidbit from the book can I use to impress someone?
Well, I mean, I guess I would pick up on a part of the one chapter we didn't talk about, which is my chapter on translation, and I would point out about the kind of the exact coincidence of the appearance of probably the most influential English translation of the Bible, the King James translation, the authorized version that was published in 1611, and the first full translation of Homer's poetry, and talk about how interesting it is that these two seminal and influential texts came out at the same time, and what that might say about English culture as it assimilates new influences in this period.
I think my favorite tidbit was the insult for Catholics. I believe it was the Jesuits specifically.
Yeah.
What are they called? Is that suits?
Suits, yeah.
Suits.
Right.
Where does that name come from?
Which probably means pig. And so I speculate. I mean, I have no way of fully confirming this, but it is interesting that it's a pejorative name that seems somewhat similar to the pejorative name that was assigned to these conversos, moranos, which at least by some accounts, the etymology of which is it's a Spanish word for pig. So in both cases, they're being characterized as pigs.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting tidbit. All right, Jeffrey, we have taken a good bit of your time. So any parting thoughts you'd like to share, and what are you working on next?
Well, I can tell you about my new project. It's a project that I've started on, and I've been nibbling away at. And in some ways comes from that third chapter, the chapter on translation. I've become very interested in the whole phenomenon of Bible translation, and I'm working on now what I'm describing as a kind of literary and cultural history of the English Bible from the first Reformation translation, which was produced by William Tyndale in 1525, and that culminates about a century later with the King James Bible in 1611. But specifically, because a number of people have written about these translations, I'm interested in how, over the course of that century, increased access to and interest in Jewish writing makes itself felt in each successive iteration of the English Bible. About 8 different translations, full translations of the English Bible, are produced in this century. And with each one, one can detect increasingly more interest in and use of Jewish writings from this period. So that's the new project.
Jeffrey, that sounds like a great project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. The book is Fictions of Conversion, Jews, Christians, and Cultures of Change in Early Modern England, out in 2013 from the University of Pennsylvania Press. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies. Thank you for joining us. Check us out at newbooksinjewishstudies.com. You can download the podcast on iTunes, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Judaism. Got an idea for a book we should cover? Send us an email, newbooksinjewishstudies@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.